Had a busy day here last live day of issues, etc. In the first hour, Dr. Paul Meyer will lend his considerable expertise, his knowledge and skill as an ancient historian. He's not ancient, but the history he studies is ancient. As a historian of ancient matters, to the Passion account, we'll get a historical perspective on the Passion of Christ, not so much the movie per se, but upon the accounts from which the movie are drawn in the Gospels. We'll be talking about that. It struck me, I saw the film earlier this afternoon, Mel Gibson's Passion, and one thing that did strike me was how far removed these events are from our 21st century experience, our Western world, the way we think, the world we live in. And yet these are the events that not only change history, but change lives, the suffering, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Dr. Paul Meyer joins us here in the first hour of the program to talk about that from a historical perspective. In the second hour, we'll spend about 25 minutes. I will offer some of my reflections. I'll have to warn you, though, my reflections on this film are somewhat half-baked because I literally left the theater, drove back over here, and I've had about 25 minutes before I go on the air. And I have some definite thoughts on it. But whenever you go through it, whenever you watch a film like this, this is one that takes some digesting, some mental digestion before you can actually say anything definitive. If anyone else has seen the film here in the last 2 days, I'd be anxious for you to chime in there during that 25 hours from 4 to 4:30 at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Then, in the last 90 minutes of the program, we will give Pastor Tom Baker his due. Last week, if you will remember, when we were broadcasting live from Concordia University, Wisconsin in Mequon, Tom Baker joined us there for a half hour, part three of our four-part series on law and gospel. We gave him rather short shrift. We're going to make up time for him and give him the last 90 minutes of the program for part four of our series on law and gospel. I would remind those who are fans of Tom and his program, Law and Gospel, it returns to the air here on AM 850 KFUO Monday. He'll also be heard tomorrow during the Ask the Pastor Hour at 10:05 with Chuck Rathert during the Bible study. So if you've been missing Tom and your radio fix, this will be your opportunity. The last 90 minutes, tomorrow morning, and then Monday with the return of Law and Gospel. That's the lineup for today. The first hour is devoted to a historical perspective on the Passion of Christ. Dr. Paul Meyer joins us, professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. He's authored numerous books, including his latest, More Than a Skeleton. Dr. Meyer, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Great to be back with you.
I often wonder how, when you're sitting in church during the Lenten season, how you see the events unplaying in your mind as we're hearing the Passion account unfold, because you are intimate as a modern person can be, with ancient history, the ancient world. You've walked these steps, and you've been over this geography and in this timeline so many times. Do you think it gives you a different perspective as an historian in matters ancient, especially first century?
Well, you'd be surprised how many parallels there are between what happened 2,000 years ago and what happens today. For example, every step in the trial of Jesus of Nazareth before Pontius Pilate, for example, has its parallels in today's jurisprudence. You know, first the prosecution lodges its charges and then tries to substantiate it, and then the defense defends the victim or the person who is involved and substantiates it. And then the cross examination takes place. You have much of this taking place in the Jesus trial before Pilate. And so there are quite a few parallels.
So the events that we're going to talk about here during this hour, Dr. Meyer, are not so far removed from our 21st century, our Western world.
Not at all.
Let's set the big context of the Roman world. You can hardly tell the Passion story without, as you already have, included the Roman role in this. Tell us about the Roman world of the first century Palestine.
Well, as of 63 BC, the Romans had taken over the last period of independence from the Jewish people under the Maccabees, and it was Pompey who decided in a quarrel between two Maccabean brothers which should be the rightful high priest and heir who led the land, and the other brother didn't like it and staged a revolution against Pompey's decision. So as of 63 BC, the Romans controlled Palestine and would continue to do so until the fall of the Roman Empire. and then you have various other groups that are in there. Now, with the Romans, again, would allow the Sanhedrin, the priestly Sanhedrin, under the command of the high priest, to generally take care of the religious matters in the land, but if anything impinged on the state's interest, of course, they would have to refer it to the state. In the year 30, about 40 years before the destruction in Jerusalem, Pontius Pilate evidently withdrew from the Jewish Sanhedrin the right to execute capital punishment. This very interesting fact that's given us in the Jewish rabbinical traditions, as well as confirmed by the first century Jewish historian Josephus. So that sets the stage for Good Friday 3 days later, 3 years later.
So really we're talking about had Jesus gone to the cross in 28 or 29, the Sanhedrin could have had him stoned.
Yeah, it wouldn't have gone to the cross at all.
Interesting.
He would have been stoned as Stephen was.
What kind of latitude were the Jewish leaders given under Roman governorship, under Pontius Pilate?
Again, they could control the religious matters. They could also, by the way, execute no less than a Roman citizen, him or herself, if any Gentile transgressed the sacred perimeter around the temple. This was a tremendous exception given the Jews even after the year 30. They were allowed to, if the governor's wife herself had gone beyond the sacred perimeter, they could have tried to stone her to death, although they wouldn't have done that, obviously. But this is what got St. Paul into trouble, for example, toward the end of the book of Acts, when they thought that he had brought an Ephesian layman named Trophimus into the sacred balustrade of the temple, which was a terrible thing, they thought. Of course, it was a mistaken identity.
Now, let's then, having talked about the Roman world, let's talk about the nature of the Jewish rule. You've mentioned the Sanhedrin also figuring prominently into the accounts of the Passion. Is the King Herod, what was the nature of his rule?
Herod Antipas, his name was. He was the most successful of the sons of Herod the Great. Now, you know, we have four generations of Herods in the New Testament. You got Herod the Great, of course, the so-called monster of the Christmas account with the slaughter of the babies in Bethlehem. Then we have his son Archelaus, who blew it, and he was banished to what is today southern France. We have Herod Antipas. He's the governor of Galilee, and he generally kept a pretty clean nose and was the most successful of Herod's sons. In fact, he was the final sovereign on earth for Jesus of Nazareth, because he was born, as you well know, in Bethlehem, but moved to Nazareth very early in life. And so that's why Pontius Pilate thought to get this tricky case out of his hands by remanding Jesus to the court of Herod Antipas, because Herod was in Jerusalem at the time for the high festivals, including the Passover. And in this way, he thought he could rid himself of this nasty case.
So it was a jurisdictional thing.
Yes. Jesus could be tried either in the place where the so-called crime was committed, or in terms of the final authority in his life, either one.
All right. What was the nature, early in the accounts, yesterday we were talking with Dr. Lewis Brighton about this. Matthew picks up in chapter 26 with Jesus in Gethsemane. He is arrested by temple guards, taken to a trial before this council of elders, the Sanhedrin. What was the nature of this trial? How would that have gone?
Well, we're not sure it was a trial. It could have been a hearing. And of course, according to the Jewish Talmud, you had to have two preliminary hearings before it went to a capital trial. And so that's about as close as we're going to come to a hearing. John mentions an appearance before Annas as well, and so that could have been in the nature of the two hearings before the official trial in the Sanhedrin, which had to take place in the morning, by the way. It was illegal to have it at night, but you could have the preliminary hearing at night, but then just endorse it the next morning. And Luke carefully tells us that that's about how it happened.
So why the timing of the preliminary hearing at night? Really, if you're given, if you try and follow the timeline of the Gospels, the dead of night. Why? Why was he arrested?
Jesus was actually a very popular figure. He remained popular with the people crying Hosanna on Palm Sunday. They never turned against him. That's one of our popular misconceptions, that they suddenly the crowd changes its mind from singing Hosanna on Sunday to yelling Crucify on Friday. It's not true. It was a different crowd. We can prove that. from, I think, what's the most overlooked verse in the Bible, Luke 23:27. Jesus is sentenced by Pilate. He's dragging the cross to Calvary. And Luke carefully tells us a great multitude of Jewish men and women were crying, weeping at Jesus' arrest and torment. So I think we've got to be very careful never to get generally, collectively anti-Semitic because of what happened on Good Friday. And that's what all the hue and the cry is about, Mel Gibson's film. They're claiming it's anti-Semitic, but it's following the Gospels pretty directly.
How big of an event would this have been, this trial before the Jews or the hearing before the Jews taken to Pilate himself? Was this a big event in Jerusalem?
Oh, I think so. It's quite clear that there is a mob of people out there. We don't know how many. It did represent, I think, only a fraction of the Jewish people at the time. And because Jesus was well known in Jerusalem at the time, and the word finally got around the next day that he was arrested, that there would have been quite a crowd, yes.
Now, if I'm getting the timeline correct, we have the nighttime hearing before the council. Are they unanimous in their condemnation of Jesus?
No, hardly. We know that Joseph of Arimathea would not have voted against Jesus, nor would Nicodemus. Probably Gamaliel didn't either, because he was a very fair-minded, flexible fellow who comes out very handsomely in both Christian and Jewish sources. So I think there'd be at least three that would not have been in the majority for condemnation. There could have been more.
Then there is the trial before Pilate, or at least what's called the first trial before Pilate, and Pilate does not seem to want to condemn him to death. Why is that?
Well, Pilate is trying to be a fair Roman prefect at the time. Of course, you don't find that picture outside of the New Testament, especially not in so many of our revisionist scholars today who are giving us a totally different view of Pilate, not having done their homework. Because Flavius Josephus gives us a very, very important case. I like to call it Good Friday 2, which happened in the year 62 A.D. And this is reported by a Jewish source, not a Christian source. It was in that year that Josephus carefully tells us, then James, the brother of Jesus, who was called the Christ, was stoned to death by the Sanhedrin in the absence of the Roman governor. His name was Albinus, and he hadn't even arrived yet to his post in Palestine. And when Albinus did arrive, he was so angry at this kangaroo court justice that he arranged for the high priest, who was one of the sons of Annas, by the way, to be canned out of office. And if this isn't a parallel to Good Friday, I don't know what is. This is the second time now a Roman governor is trying to do the right thing in the case of a Christian.
So for the kind of the Sunday school picture that was painted for us, Pilate as either bloodthirsty, completely callous toward this whole case, just trying to get rid of it, you would see, in terms of its history, Pilate trying to act not only in his own best interest, but he's just trying to do his job.
Well, yeah, the four Gospels really picture Pilate almost as Jesus' lawyer for the defense. He's trying every means at his disposal to unload this case. He tries quashing it for lack of evidence several times. He tries the Passover amnesty bit, shall I release to you Jesus or Barabbas? He tries change of venue when Herod Antipas is in town. You know, he says, hey, let's get rid of this case, send it over to him. Even the terrible scourgings were intended to allay the bloodthirst of the crowd. And this, of course, is where I think Mel Gibson overdid it a little bit in The Passion. It's just too much scourging.
Well, yeah, it did go on for quite some time.
Well, it just, you know, it really, Jesus looks like walking hamburger almost, you know? And I don't think he could possibly have carried his cross 10 feet. Not to say along the whole road to Calvary until Simon of Cyrene helped him with it.
I want to get to that in just a minute, but I have one curious question that always kind of sticks out like a sore thumb whenever we hear these accounts read in church, and that is this reconciliation between Pilate and the Jewish king Herod on this day when they are sending Jesus back and forth amongst them. What's going
on? Well, that's a perfectly fascinating episode, and I finally found the truth of that when I was doing research years ago in my book Pontius Pilate. We know exactly what that is now. It's the episode of the Golden Roman Shields, which you don't find in the Bible, but here's the point. The scriptural record is so beautifully historical that we can find biblical type of information also in secular sources. And this is a fascinating thing. Pilate hangs a couple of golden shields over his desk about a year before Good Friday. And this caused another commotion. He gets a visit from Herod Antipas and his three brothers, and they say, take the shields down, Pilate. And he knew what they were doing to him, because Herod Antipas is lusting for Pilate's job, and they're trying to trump up a harmless situation like this. Pilate doesn't take the shields down. There's no reason for him to do so. But Herod then writes the emperor Tiberius behind Pilate's back, complaining about that. And then Tiberius, without even hearing Pilate's side of it, sends a letter to him in very angry Latin saying, you know, Pilate, take down those blankety-blank shields, and from now on you're on probation. Don't antagonize the Jewish people in any areas concerning their religious beliefs, or you will have outlived your usefulness in Judea. See, this shows why Pilate is under pressure on Good Friday and why he can't simply brusquely cancel the trial out. So many of our theologians today are saying, oh, come on, if Pilate really... Pilate wouldn't have deigned to debate with the crowd like that. He would simply have cleared the courtyard and surrounded Jesus with an honor guard and marched him back to Nazareth. It just isn't true. These people haven't done their homework. They don't know what's up.
So Pilate's on a short leash with the emperor.
Right.
And the last thing Tiberius emperor, what's the last thing he wants in Palestine?
Well, he simply
insurrection?
Doesn't want any further rebellions anywhere in the empire, and that the riot could break out there very easily. We know this is how the Great War with Rome began in the year 66 AD, when the last Roman governor, a total rat, he made Pontius Pilate look like a saint by comparison. His name was Gessius Florus, and he had flaunted so many Jewish customs that he knew there could be a revolt, so he had a whole legion come down from Antioch. So now he had not only 600 police like Pilate did, but he had about 5,600 more. And when the lid blew, they were not able to resist the Jewish rebels, and they chased them halfway to the Mediterranean. So the New Testament is deadly accurate when it says that when Pilate saw that a riot was developing, that's when he called for the basin and washed his hands.
Let's talk about that scourging then. I have just come from the theater having seen Gibson's Passion, and the scourging is the hardest part to watch, except maybe even the walk along the Via Dolorosa to the cross. That's hard to watch as well, but you think it is overplayed a bit. What would then a typical Roman scourging of this kind, trying to appease an angry crowd, what would it have consisted of?
Well, it would consisted of whips and then also flagellation by bone chips that were embedded in leather, and it would have lacerated Jesus' back, there's no question about it. But don't forget, Pilate had wanted to make of Jesus a punished example, not a dead man. But the crowd then, you know, turned against him also and yelled for crucifixion. Okay. Now, again, let's remember that crowd represents only the temple establishment. It does not represent all the people in Jerusalem. Well, here's the point. This is the only negative thing I found. Otherwise, the Mel Gibson's Passion is very faithful to the New Testament. He just overdid it with the scourging. Jesus is so horribly whipped that he can't stand anymore, and there is no way he could have dragged his cross. And we know he was dragging his cross until Simon of Cyrene helped him when he collapsed. But the collapse would have taken place before Jesus even got out to the street if Jesus was as horrendously, horrendously scourged as in the Mel Gibson movie.
Now, the whole issue of carrying the cross, I noticed that that at least in the film, they kind of play it both ways. They have the thieves carrying the cross members of the crosses. They have Jesus carrying a full-blown, full-size cross.
I didn't understand that at all. They only carried the patibulum or cross beam, and so I don't know why Jesus then wouldn't have carried just the cross beam as well. Weighed about 50, 60 pounds, still a load, and you would have collapsed under it. But that heavy cross that Jesus, my goodness, even if Jesus were in perfect condition, after a block or so, you would get tired.
the whole idea, why would the Romans have them carry their own crosses? Even thieves, it seems as though thievery wouldn't have been an executable offense. What's going on with this whole notion of crucifixion and the kind of the public spectacle that it seems to be?
Well, don't forget that the malefactors crucified on either side of Jesus were a little more than thieves. They were malefactors, and Barabbas had committed murder, you know, recall, in the insurrection, whatever that was, even though Barabbas, of course, came off scot-free. That was nicely pictured, by the way, when he laughs at the crowd, you know. But very often the Romans did make the victims carry crosses. Yes, it was part of the indignity of it all.
Is that...
People, you know, you dig your own grave at times, same deal.
So the Roman system of crucifixion is intended to be a public indignity.
Well, it's a negative ad. You know, don't do what this miscreant did or you're going to end up in the cross like he is.
The punishment, the walk out to the cross, what are we talking about in terms of time frame? Because the gospel accounts have Jesus tried in the morning. By noon, he's nailed to the cross.
Well, the timeline's correct, and Jesus dies in only 3 hours, and I think this is one demonstration that Mel Gibson's version is not all wrong by any means, because he was inflicted terribly by the torturous scourging, and we don't know what happened Thursday night, you know, after this nocturnal hearing in the Sanhedrin. He was mistreated all night, no sleep, probably tortured even then. So it's possible to die in only 3 hours, yes, absolutely.
Do we know the footprints in which he walked? Are those the kind of things that you can go over to Jerusalem now and say, okay, we know where he was tried, we know his path to the place where he was crucified, and we know the place where he was crucified?
Pretty nearly, yes. The typical Via Dolorosa, however, is wrong. The idea is that Jesus was appearing before Pilate in the Tower Antonia, but that's wrong. He appeared before Pilate at his residence, which was the royal palace of King Herod, in the western part of the city. We know this is where the Roman governors regularly had their shelter in the holy city, and besides which Pilate would not have had his wife subjected to the stinking military barracks like the Tower Antonia. So the real way of the cross goes pretty well straight north from the western edge of Old Jerusalem to the what is today the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, marking where Calvary was located.
And do we have a pretty good idea about where that location is?
I think we do. Yes, we do, because when Constantine's engineers were trying to commemorate the place where Jesus hung on the cross, he went to the Christian bishop of Jerusalem. His name was Macarius, and they asked him, do you know where Jesus was crucified? Immediately he could point it out. So, and it was outside the city walls in those days. So the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, even though today it is encrusted with so much church architecture and icons and whatever else through the centuries, is really the place.
Dr. Paul Meyer is our guest. We're getting his historical perspective on the Passion of Christ. He's professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, and he's authored many books, including his latest, More Than a Skeleton. When we come back, we're going to talk a bit about the other time frame, not only the historical time frame of a Roman occupation, but also the Passover, the time of the Passover, and what Jerusalem and its environs would have been like during the events that we call the Passion of Christ. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Feel free to give us a call during this break with a question or a comment. We'll be right back.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do you know God's will for your daily life? Is God's will a mystery? Do we need to look for a sign from God to know what to do at any given moment? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. I've written an article in the latest edition of the Issues, Etc. journal titled Locus and Focus, God's Will for Your Daily Life. The recent issue also contains a review of Armageddon, the latest in the Left Behind series, and Aaron Wolf details his spiritual journey to the Reformation from the legalism of evangelicalism. His article is titled, A Beggar on the Wittenberg Trail. Plus, you'll find a list of tape and book resources. You can receive the next edition of the Issues Etc. Journal by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172, or write Issues Etc. Journal, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117.
Now this Global Minute lets you hear about the Sri Lankan national holiday this month. Bringing people together in this country off the coast of India is tough. Sri Lanka is a country where people need prayer. The majority are Buddhists. They're called Sinhalese. There's another large group known as the Tamils, and they're primarily Hindus whose families originally immigrated from India. Meanwhile, there's a large population of Christians from Dutch descent and Muslims who live in clusters throughout the country. There's been an ongoing conflict between the Sinhalese majority and the Tamils. Muslim businessmen and families have stayed away from the political conflicts. Pray that Christ's truth will stand out in Sri Lanka, a place with many mixed religious messages. Pray for Christian leaders to have courage as they share their faith. Learn more about the needs around the world by visiting the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Today's media story, The Ball. Last year, October 14th, Game 6 of the National League Championship Series. Winner goes to the World Series. The Cubs are ahead of the Florida Marlins 3-0. Luis Castillo fouls Mark Pryor's pitch down the left field line. Moises Alou is poised to catch it, but a fan reaches up and Alou can't make the out. The Cubs blow the lead, lose the game 8-3, and end up losing the series. Tonight, that ball will be destroyed. Grant DePorter bought the ball for almost $114,000 so that he could destroy it and get it out of the Cubs' jinxed psyche. It's a great illustration of moving on. Isaiah 43:19 says, "Forget the former things. Do not dwell on the past. See, I am doing a new thing." Sure, we live with the consequences of our past. But past sins have been buried with Christ, and every day now offers hope for the future. Paul says in Philippians 3:14, "One thing I do, forgetting what is behind and straining toward what is ahead, I press on toward the goal to win the prize for which God has called me heavenward in Christ Jesus." The ball will be destroyed this evening at 7:31 at Harry Carey's in Chicago.
Confession, says an old proverb, is good for the soul. In the season of Lent, Christians around the world recommit themselves to honest confession and repentance, and sure enough, the soul is able to sing. You'll hear it on the next Sing for Joy.
Sunday at noon on AM 850 KFUO.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk about the teachings and practices of Jehovah's Witnesses. Gretchen Pasentino of Answers in Action will be our guest. It's a very interesting two-hour conversation with Gretchen, and I urge you to tune in tomorrow on the program. We're talking about a historical perspective on the Passion of Christ. Dr. Paul Meyer is our guest. He's professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, and he's author of numerous books, including his latest called More Than a Skeleton. Let's take a minute here, Dr. Meyer, if you would, and tell us about More Than a Skeleton.
Well, this was in answer to what so many Christians are so head up on recently, and that is the end times prophetic approach toward Christianity. Ever since the Left Behind series came along that was cited in your commercial, you recall, there has been a positive frenzy about concern over the end times and how it's going to happen. And in the Left Behind series, of course, you have these an enormous trail of very weird stories involving tribulation, the Antichrist, the rapture, and so forth. And many people, especially outside of the church, are thinking that this is what all Christians believe is going to happen about the end times, and that's not true at all. And I was kind of shocked once I added the figures up that probably only 4 or 5% of world Christendom believes in that particular scenario. Roman Catholics don't believe it. They're amillennials, that is, non-millennials. That's one out of every two Christians. Lutherans don't. That's 65, 70 million more. Eastern Orthodox don't. That's 375 million more. Anglicans don't, 70 million, and on down to the mainstream. And then it turns out that really only primarily in the United States among evangelicals do you find that this particular view of the end times is so current. And so I decided, since fiction is promoting this idea, I would use fiction also in terms of trying to oppose it. And so I have this interesting scenario, I hope it's interesting, of the protagonist, who's the same protagonist, by the way, as the previous book, which is A Skeleton in God's Closet. The protagonist, a professor from Harvard, encounters a figure in the Holy Land who might be the return Jesus in an interim advent. In other words, God can do anything. He can send Christ at the end of time, but maybe also before the end of time to help the church. And what would happen? What would the fallout be? So it's just a lot of fun.
Sounds very interesting, in fact. Dr. Meyer, let's talk a bit, if we could, about the other context of the whole Passion account. We talked about the Roman occupation, but more immediately, there is also the festival of the Passover. That is the framework around which the Passion, or within which the Passion takes place. What would Jerusalem and its environs have been like during this time of the year for the Jewish people?
Well, Jerusalem, for one, would be a city, usually 50,000, the greatest city, of course, in the Holy Land, and it would have been about 50,000 normal population. But during the festival high and holy season, it would be expanding to at least three or four times as many, as the pilgrims came from really all over the world, all over the Mediterranean world, and would have to live more or less in a ring of canvas suburbs, you might say, around the city of Jerusalem. So it's an exciting time, of course. It's a time that would show the cohesion of the Jewish people in the Mediterranean world. And it was at that time of the year that Pontius Pilate would have to be on police duty in Jerusalem to make sure that no riot developed that could get out of control. Most of the time, he would live in his seaside palace of Herod again, Caesarea on the Mediterranean. Beautiful site archaeologically to the present day.
That is, by the way, if I'm not mistaken, where they finally located solid archaeological evidence of Pilate's existence.
Absolutely. The Pontius Pilate stone was discovered there, right.
Would a Roman governor have wanted to carry out crucifixions, public executions, in Jerusalem at the time of this religious festival?
Well, again, you have to remember that the Roman governor has only five cohorts of 600 each to keep peace in all the land, and occasionally some kind of preventive medicine was necessary, you might say, to make sure that people didn't ride roughshod or try to rebel against the Roman occupation. So periodically, crucifixion is the best way to do this. Again, it's such a public negative ad for not doing what this miscreant did. So, yes, it'd be kind of typical, unfortunately.
You mentioned before the break that the place of Christ's crucifixion was outside the city walls at the time. Was there a reason for this?
Well, you could never. You would desecrate the city itself if you had a horrible execution like this within the city walls. So it was usually on a main roadway outside of the walls of the city. And the traditional site for Golgotha is indeed on the road to Joppa, or Jaffa as it's called today, outside the western walls of the old city.
So we're talking about a place that would have been very public, and you would have had at least the quote-unquote benefit of a lot of traffic.
Exactly. Exactly. In fact, the Gospels say this place was very near the city.
Was crucifixion the primary means that the Romans used to carry out capital punishment?
Well, it was the punishment used for stellar criminals, you might say, traitors to the state, the rebels against the Roman Empire, slaves, those who were traitors to the state, as I said. It was the worst form of torture, according to Cicero. It was just a hideous thing. Sometimes you didn't die mercifully within 3 hours, as Jesus did. Josephus reports that two of his friends were on crosses outside of Jerusalem. He finally discovered that after 3 days, and they were still alive, and he begged the General Vespasian to allow him to take, or Titus, I should say, to take them down from the cross. Two died, but one still survived.
So people might have survived a crucifixion.
Oh, if they were taken down, yes.
Was the goal then, you put a man on a cross, and he dies eventually of what? And what, in days? Was that the goal here?
Well, there were about 900 crucified after the Spartacus rebellion. in the 65 BC or so, and there were hundreds along the Appian Way, and some lasted for some days. That's right.
What was the point of the breaking of the legs?
This removes now the human body from having any strong basis on which to the skeleton itself, the skeletal of the rest of the body, can rest in order to even breathe properly. Now, you remove that and just hang there. You try hanging some time. Pretty soon, you find it very difficult to breathe. And so they finally die by asphyxiation.
The nails, the ropes. I've seen all sorts of depictions of this in artwork. Some have Jesus merely pinned by nails. Some of them have the ropes holding him up. What did the Romans do?
Well, all of the above. They would often use ropes to hold down the victim before they drove the nail in. It used to be doubted that they ever nailed Jesus to the cross. In fact, the late Bishop Pike claimed that this was an exaggeration by John's Gospel, but the evidence is really very strong that this happened, because in 1971, they found a victim north of Jerusalem whose his heel bones were transfixed by one huge spike. It was 7 inches long. And it was being driven into a olive wood cross. It hit, encountered a knot on the way into the cross, and that bent the tip back on itself, and they were unable to extract it. So there's proof positive archaeologically that, yes, they did indeed nail people to the cross. However, human flesh is very fragile, and to improve the holding capacity of that nail, they often had the nail first or spike go into a wooden shim or washer, which then with this washer effect would hold more flesh. And indeed, there are the rotting remains of acacia wood under the head of this nail, showing that that's how they did it for this victim.
So they were very efficient. They didn't want these people flopping off the cross.
Exactly.
The whole notion of the palm, you know, that's the traditional place for the mark of the cross, or the wrist. I remember being in grade school and one of my teachers saying, well, you know, we always see the holes in Jesus' palms, but in fact, the Romans really, when they did nail people to the cross, nailed through the wrist. What do we know?
Either one. The wrist was common. For instance, this victim I just referred to, had the nail in his distal end of his right radius bone, there was a hole found. Other times, Mel Gibson was right. You notice in the film, they had the arms tied first, and then the nail went in, but what was not correct is there was no shim or washer under the head of that nail, and there should have been.
So we have, I'm trying to picture this, in the Gibson film, you see before the crucifixion, as Jesus is headed out, the Roman soldiers kind of preparing the place of execution. There are already some upright members there at this place of execution. How did
generally,
it go?
Generally, the stake, the upright stake was there. And the patibulum or crossbeam had a hole in it, which just went that down over the head of the stake, and that is generally how it worked.
For Jesus to die in 6 hours, I mean, a grand total, you said 3 hours, actually, if you counted up, is this unusual? Because at least one of the gospel accounts says that the centurion is rather surprised that he's dead in such short order.
Well, that's right, and this simply shows the maltreatment of Jesus. The mistreatment shows again that Mel Gibson is not entirely wrong here at all, that there was a horrible scourging, drained Jesus' blood the night before. He was probably given no rest whatever and was taunted and tormented by Caiaphas's people. We think that this is the reason that he just was. He's too tired even to carry his own cross. So the thieves can do it, but he can't.
Let's talk then about the timeline from Christ's death. The one thing that has always struck me as interesting is that Joseph of Arimathea, who you mentioned before, is also a member of the council, probably not, certainly not complicitous in the charges to accuse him. Joseph of Arimathea wants Jesus down off the cross and is able to get him off the cross. Tell us about that.
Well, after the victim died, the Romans didn't much care who took the body. The justice was done and fine. They're kind of happy to have the body taken away. They don't have to bury it. And so Joseph of Arimathea, a member of the Sanhedrin, he did not consent to Jesus' death sentence, and he provided his tomb for Jesus' interment. And another friend of his, Nicodemus, came along and helped him in terms of a preliminary burial of the body after first asking Pontius Pilate for permission. And he also was kind of surprised that it happened so soon.
The burial you said is preliminary.
The burial, yes, it was preliminary because this was the first century AD when they used the space-saving way of burying people called the second burial method, in which the body was decomposing for a year or two, then they gathered the bones that remained and put them into an ossuary. That's a stone bone chest. And this happened in Jerusalem only from 20 BC to 70 AD, a 90-year period. And, you know, one of the stunning archaeological discoveries was the Caiaphas ossuary, where the bones of the high priest himself have been discovered, the first biblical personality ever, in one of these ossuaries. So it's a thrilling discovery.
So this is why the gospel writers can talk about Joseph of Arimathea's tomb as a new tomb in which no one had ever been laid.
Wait, that's exactly right.
Would this have been like a family tomb, room enough for more than one person?
Indeed, there were many family tombs, and that seems to be the case indeed.
Do we know where it's at?
Well, once again, this is where Constantine's engineers built a great rotunda over that very tomb. They had carved it out of the surrounding escarpment, because it was probably, you know, a tunnel type of tomb in the escarpment. And that, of course, is a first error. They shouldn't have done that. And then they put a big rotunda around it. And later on, they connected this to the church housing Golgotha. And then today, that's all under the roof of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem.
So what, within 50 yards of the site of the crucifixion, someplace like that?
About that, a little less. And don't forget, the Gospel of John says there was in the place where he was crucified a new tomb in which a man had not yet been laid.
We're talking with Dr. Paul Meyer, professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, getting an historical perspective on the Passion of Christ. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. Marie is on the line calling from Webster Groves. Marie, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. First of all, I want to say I have enjoyed thoroughly just about every book that you've put out. I enjoy them very much, and thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate that.
The question I have is, I'd like to know what the validity is, or if there's any truth to this, that it's been Jewish tradition to sacrifice the lamb at 3 o'clock on the Sabbath or on that Friday or whatever, and what then that Jesus died at 3 o'clock was significant. Have you ever heard that before?
Well, as a matter of fact, I'm embarrassed to say I had not. No, I had not. And of course, this would not be the reason that non-Christian Jews would sacrifice at that time. And of course, they don't sacrifice anymore today at all. In fact, that quit with the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in the year 70. So all of Judaism today is synagogue Judaism rather than temple Judaism, and they don't have sacrifice anymore.
There's a little wrinkle in the timeline that often gives people fits when it comes to the whole issue of getting Jesus off the cross in time for preparation for the Sabbath, and then trying to account for 3 days dead in the tomb before his resurrection. How do we sort this out?
Well, it's the Jewish method of reckoning, which is called the inclusive method of reckoning, in which a fraction counts for the whole, part counts for the whole. And, for instance, the Jew would not say Herod ruled 37 years, he ruled and 3 months, he would say Herod ruled for 38 years. And you can see this. If you have 3.5 pails of water, how many pails are involved? 4. See, that's the inclusive method of reckoning. And so part counts for the whole. And so you get your 3 days there. Jesus dies at 3 p.m. on Friday, or 4 p.m. or whatever. And the first day is a little shorty. It's between that time and sundown. That's day one. Day two is a full 24-hour day, sundown Friday to sundown Saturday. Day three is sundown Saturday to whenever the resurrection happened on Sunday.
So we have 3 days, and we don't have to make it 3 24-hour days.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Let's then talk about also the burial. It was preliminary, but it also involves some Roman officialdom in it, too, because the Jewish leaders are also in on the burial of Jesus. Tell us about that.
The burial customs, you mean?
Well, the Jewish officials are almost as concerned about the nature of Jesus' burial as are Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus. They want to make sure someone doesn't come and steal the body.
I'm sorry. Yes, indeed. The Jewish officials are very concerned that somebody might steal the body and therefore the tomb should be guarded, lest the disciples steal that body and then advertise the resurrection as such. So that's very interesting. In fact, it's one of the earliest naturalistic explanations for what happened on Easter Sunday morning.
They say post a watch and set a seal on the tomb. What would that have implied?
Well, the seal is just like that little silver aluminum thing you find in your electric meters. It's not going to hermetically seal it, cement it shut so you can't get it open. It's rather to indicate tampering. And so there would be a wax type of seal with a string or something like that attached to a thread or a cord of some kind to indicate that there was no tampering done. And this was another way to make assurance, doubly sure, that there'd be no theft.
Let's go back to the phones. Jeff is calling from his car. Jeff, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. The question I have and comment has to do with Mel Gibson's torturous of Christ's body. And I think of the text that Christ would drink the full cup of God's wrath. And I thought Mel did a real good job of leaving that there was no drop for us to drink.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Your thoughts, Dr. Meyer?
Well, certainly he drained the full cup of pain and suffering visually on that film. There's no question about that. Again, it's still very fresh in my memory because I just saw it last night. And it's just a cavalcade of torture. I guess that I thought that Via Dolorosa, or the trip out to the cross, you know, would never end. And they kept whipping Jesus, you know, on the way to the cross. I really don't think that would have happened. The scourging had taken place, and the Romans were rather grimly efficient. They wanted to get the job over with, and they're not going to torment the guy who's already carrying a cross. So I think that was a little bit overdone.
I can't get the image of those. There are two Roman soldiers that carry out most of the flogging. They seem to be throughout the entire crucifixion scene as well. And I'm thinking to myself, I imagine that the Roman cohort must have kept guys like this on hand, guys to do the dirty work here, but they did seem to be enjoying themselves quite a bit. Does that jive with what you would consider accurate history with regard to the way the Romans carried these things out?
Well, you're going to find military men, you know, making bad jokes about victims and prisoners. It's a disgusting job. Somebody's got to do it kind of a thing. And so I think this is quite realistic.
Lael is calling from Webster Groves. Lael, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Pastor.
Sure.
I have a question. When Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus took Christ's body, didn't that contaminate them for Passover? I mean, weren't they involved in removing his body and touching a dead body and putting him in the grave?
Good question, Lael. Thank you.
They certainly would have, and that's the reason why they wanted to get this done before sundown. That way they wouldn't have contaminated the Passover day itself.
So they were willing to become ceremonially unclean themselves. They didn't want to do that on the Sabbath day.
Exactly. Todd, I'm afraid I'm going to have to leave you at this point. I just so much appreciated the questions. I know it's a terrible curve to throw you, but I'm sure you can fill the last 5 minutes in terms of your own experience of the Mel Gibson Passion play. It turns out there was a change of plans on this end, so I really have to run.
We were happy to have you for as long as we could have you, Dr. Meyer.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate the people calling in.
Dr. Paul Meyer is professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. He has authored many books. His latest is called More Than a Skeleton. It's a sequel of sorts to The Skeleton in God's Closet, getting a historical perspective on the Passion of the Christ. Now, I had opportunity earlier today to go and see the film itself. Oh, what do you say? What do you say? I'll tell you one thing, folks. I came back to my office and I opened up my Bible. Now, the first place I was tempted to look was into the gospel accounts, because after you watch this, it is a rather overwhelming experience. It's all coming at you rather quickly and packed into just over 2 hours, 12 hours of an account. Some of the details are there. Some of the details are left out. Some things are added in. My first impulse was to try and test it for its accuracy to the gospel accounts. But then I thought better of that, because no film can be completely accurate. I mean, to be completely accurate would have had to have been a 12-hour film, and it probably would have taxed even the most intrepid filmgoer's patience. I turned instead to Isaiah chapter 53. Now, I did this for two reasons. One was because I am convinced, even after only having digested the film for an hour or so, that this is the real script of Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, Isaiah chapter 53, the so-called suffering servant chapter of that prophet. And for the other reason, and that is that Mel Gibson fairly well invites you to do it in the very opening sequence of the film, before you see Jesus, before you enter the Garden of Gethsemane, before any of the gore and the blood and the torture and the pain and the crucifixion begin, Mel Gibson hands us one verse from Isaiah chapter 53. So I opened up my Bible and I began to read, and I thought to myself, if someone was going to take Isaiah chapter 53, knowing what we know now by way of its true fulfillment in Jesus Christ, if one was going to take Isaiah chapter 53 and put it on the silver screen, I can hardly think of a better way to do it than the way Mel Gibson has done it. Is the film perfect? By no means. By no means. No film is. And, as I said yesterday prior to seeing the movie, I will repeat it again here, it's just a movie. It is a movie. I always sit way up near the top of the theater. I like that view for some reason. I was close enough to the projection room that I could actually, through the entire film, hear the clicking of the projection machine. Clickety, 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 click. I could hear the whole thing all the way through. It didn't disturb me. In fact, I was kind of glad that I could hear the mechanism that was bringing these flickering images to me on the screen. It reminded me that I'm watching a movie. The person I see depicting Jesus is James Caviezel. He's an actor. The blood, not real. The gore, not real. The pain, not real. Every person on the screen is an actor. These are sets. These are special effects. I am not getting a newsreel of first century Palestine. It is just a movie. With that said, it's a movie with a very clear message, and that message being Isaiah chapter 53, the suffering servant. He was wounded for our transgressions. He bore our sins and carried our sorrows. The chastisement that made us whole was laid upon him. When we come back from this break, more reflections on Mel Gibson's film. If you've seen it, I invite your calls, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.